Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us Prairie du Chien High School. With those students, please stand. Thank you very much for coming. You may be seated. We also have Ripon College pre-law students. Would they stand? Welcome to you all. It is a recurring practice over the years that Ripon College pre-law students come, and we're always delighted to see you. You may be seated. The high school students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students across the state are invited to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students accept the invitation, they are sent materials about the case. They may engage in some activities relating to this case, and then come, listen to oral argument, and at noon, a justice of this court is assigned to meet with the students. We discuss the procedures of the court in hearing cases and deciding them. We don't discuss with the students the substantive issues of the case involved. And we welcome everybody to join in the proceedings at noon. It's not limited to the students, so you're all cordially invited. I'll ask if anyone here wishes a summary of the case we are about to hear. If you do, please raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice, and I will be meeting with the students at noon, right after the second oral argument here. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman.
And I will be meeting with the Ripon College students.
Ah, you're a graduate of Ripon.
Yes.
I have an honorary degree from Ripon. It's important to do that, because then you don't have all the work. Right.
Right. Else had to work for it.
You could talk together.
Yes, we could. Seated next to Justice Gableman is Justice Patience Rogensack. And to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. With those introductions made, I will call our first case for today, which is 92AP 3208D, Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility, now known as the Office of Lawyer Regulation, versus David V. Jennings. Representing himself is David Jennings, Mr. Jennings.
Good morning. Please the court. I am David B. Jennings III. I'm here this morning in furtherance of my pursuit to reinstate the law license which I voluntarily surrendered in 1992 and this court had revoked in January of 1993. I don't anticipate taking the full amount of the allotted time. I do want to recap some of the most relevant facts as they relate to the background. I very much wish to be an attorney again. As much as it's a privilege to be here and face you this morning, it's a tremendous privilege to be a lawyer. My grandfather was a lawyer, graduated from Marquette in 1911. He served the citizens of Wisconsin, both in the Assembly and in the Senate, for a number of years. After my father was born, my grandfather, who had a special penchant for civil service, he had written on it, he had pursued laws on it, he had spoken around the country on it. He came back to Milwaukee County and he served for many years as a civil service commissioner. My father, after the Second World War, graduated from Marquette University in 1948. He was admitted on July 13th of 1948, and I was born on July 20th of 1948. All of my lifetime as I was growing up, I looked forward to the opportunity to become an attorney. I graduated from law school after my grandfather had passed away, but I practiced initially with the Reinhardt Berner firm in Milwaukee. I had clerked for them, for Jack Reinhardt, while I was working to get myself through school. I graduated in 1975. I stayed with that firm, Reinhardt Berner, for several years until I joined a smaller boutique firm, which is the firm I practiced with for the majority of my practice. I had been a civil litigator for the most part, both in the state and the federal court. In 1985, I became involved in a very complex bankruptcy, which almost totally took my time for a number of years. That case, I administered about $55 million, which in today's dollars is not significant, but at that time it was. I was appointed by the Federal Bankruptcy Court to handle 7 of maybe 13 separate entities. We were very successful in liquidating the assets of this Chapter 11 proceeding. However, and regrettably and shamefully, during a period of time that ended in 1992, I took money from my clients. I was shamed at that time. I've been ashamed of that ever since. I have done what I can to try to right that wrong. The discovery came to light because the State of Wisconsin Department of Revenue had done an audit. The auditor contacted the trustee for the bankruptcy court in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, where the majority of the cases were. He contacted the court-appointed, it's a Chapter 11, there was no trustee, but his role was called designated person for the debtor in possession. The individual's name was Bill Brandt, William Brandt, and his company, Development Specialists, were the court-appointed officers for those bankruptcy entities. He called me on a Wednesday night in July of 1992. He asked me what had happened. I told him what I had done. Within 2 days, he had representatives in my office. I turned over all of my records. I withdrew from the case. Within a few days, I notified my law partners of what I had done, the gravity of the situation. I notified them immediately that I was withdrawing from the practice of law, recognizing the severity of what I had done. I stayed in my office without practicing law for about 30 days in order to wind down my practice, in order to collect some additional fees for the benefit of the firm. And in the end of August of 1992, I totally withdrew from the practice of law. As indicated earlier, this court did accept my voluntary surrender, and my license was revoked in January of 1992. This is my third effort in attempting to restore the license. In 1999, I filed a petition. The Board of Attorney Professional Responsibility was the active entity at that time, investigated the background. We had a hearing in 2000. Following that hearing and following the report of then the Office of Lawyer Regulation in February of 2001, I requested this court that I could withdraw that petition, which I did. I waited more than 5 years thereafter, almost 7 years, to file a second petition. There was a report from the OLR on that petition. There was a hearing on that petition. The referee recommended against at that time. I appealed at that time. I was here 2 years ago. This court did deny that petition. There were a combination of reasons, but I think it was on a very narrow issue, among other things, to identify the amount which I then owed my law firm. My clients had been paid in full in 1995, or possibly in 94.
Your clients were paid in full, not though from you, is that correct, but from the insurance companies of your law firm?
Absolutely, yes. The amount that I had confessed in the amount of judgments was $550,000 principal and interest, which I did in June of 1993. The amount of the settlement was $500,000. I'm going to assume, because it's not clear, that that was based on an agreement and the principal amount. There were three contributors to that settlement. The law firm contributed $175,000. The malpractice insurer contributed $175,000, and Bill Brandt and his company, Development Specialists, contributed $150,000. They have been partially but not totally repaid in the course of time.
What's partial?
I'm sorry?
How much is partial?
The law firm and the malpractice insurer received $152,700 and some dollars from the sale of all my property in 1997.
Out of roughly...
350 was their contribution to the settlement. Mr. Brandt and his company have not as yet received any money whatsoever.
What about your family?
As a result also of the sale, my family received $92,000 and some change, approximately 43% of their claims. My father had a mortgage interest. He was the seller of the farm that my then-wife and I had purchased and owned. And my mother also had a claim against me because I had taken money from her trust as well, which we've gone into, I think, in sufficient detail in the past. Additionally, the federal federal court, by my stipulation, had ordered me to pay $39,750 to the Milwaukee Cheese ESOT. Those claimants had all been paid in full. So as the result of a hearing in 1998 in front of the federal judge, the amounts that I have been paying on a monthly basis out of my earnings for all these years is going to the Federal Crime Victims Fund because there are no identified victims. So the clients have been paid in full. My law firm has been paid in part. The malpractice insurer shared on an equal basis with my law firm. My parents have received money in part. The balance of what was originally $590,000 in the federal court is down today a little bit below $2,500. Those monies have been paid out of my earnings. As I indicated, all of my property was sold in 1997, and all that money went to creditors. One of the things that has changed since then is that I have made significant progress with my former law firm in settling our claims. Some of my former partners have left the firm, but the core of the firm and the ones whom I had joined with when I did, with the exception of Tom Godfrey, who died 2 years ago, and I have met, we've communicated, I stayed in regular contact with them, and we've reached a point of understanding, although it has not been finalized. I reached a point of understanding with my family members. My mother forgave me before she died in 1995. My father, before he died last year, supported my efforts to reinstate my license. My brothers and sisters, who would be the heirs and beneficiaries of my mother's trust, where I had taken money, also have come to an understanding. They know my economic standing, which is limited. Although I have worked hard, I have stayed very much away from the practice of law. I have had, and it's clear in the record, what has been characterized by the OLR and others as an exemplary work history, but in a retail setting.
You're the manager at Porter's Furniture in Milwaukee, is that?
I was until after 153 years in business.
Okay.
It was closed last year, which is unfortunate. I was the last person standing. One of my supporters that has submitted letters to the OLR and is part of the record was the owner of the company, Mr. Waters is in his 80s, and he had indicated among all of the other people that I had worked with over the years how responsible I was, how reliable I was, how diligent I had been.
Counselor, what was it that caused you to take money from your clients back in the 90s that is no longer present today, so we can rely on the fact you'll be honest with client feelings?
Very fair question. I had enjoyed the successes of the practice of law and had earned a substantial amount of money for a period of time. I had taken this farm property to a higher level, which was very expensive. It was not a dairy farm. It was a horse farm. And we had spent money on the farm. When my income fluctuated, I started small, and over a period of time, it was an incredible amount of money, which even at the time, as much as I kept records, I was appalled at what I had done. That farm is sold. My wife and I have been divorced. I have no activity, even though horses had been a part of my life from a very early age. My grandfather was a very avid horseback rider. He and I rode when he was 86, a couple of days before he died. My dad was an avid horseback rider. We grew up with horses. I used to ride. Since July of 1992, I have not gotten on a horse. Cleaned a few stalls along the way, but I've not gotten on a horse at all. More importantly, and I went into this both with Referee Volke in 2008 and again with Referee Harris more recently, I have completely and totally changed my lifestyle. I had lived in a fairly large house on a large farm in an affluent part of Ozaukee County. That house and farm were sold, although I will tell you that my former wife did repurchase a portion of that farm, which was her business part. She did that on her own. I have no interest in that. I've had no activities with relation to that. But I moved first into a small apartment in Cedarburg in 2000, paying rent under $500 a month, paying all my bills on a timely basis, current bills on a regular basis, but also taking the money that I was earning and, as best I could and under circumstances that I believed were correct, I paid the obligations that I had, both current and previous, to a point where the nearly $900,000 of federal taxes that were the result of my thefts were compromised and paid in full over a period of time. Additionally, the taxes that were due the state of Wisconsin, which were more than $450,000 attributable to my thefts, were compromised and are paid now almost in full. The total due the state of Wisconsin is in the range of $3,000 as it remains today. But I changed my lifestyle. I lived then in an inexpensive apartment. I paid my bills on a current basis. I did, for a short period of time, move back in with my now former wife. She had major hip surgery. I did move in, and I helped her for a period of time, although we lived in different parts of the house. We were not living as husband and wife. 6 years or 5 years ago, when my son finished school, finished college, as soon as he graduated, I moved into a small apartment on the west side of Milwaukee in a very respectable but, I would say, blue-collar neighborhood. I live in a building that's owned by a family member. I do the maintenance around the building. I shovel the snow in the winter. I take care of things so that I'm paying all my bills on a current basis. That's one of the major things that has changed, my outlook, my lifestyle, my understanding of the importance of living within one's means, which I had failed to do for a period of time. Now, there's no justification for the money that I had taken, and that's not offered as an explanation, only a recitation of what did occur. And I was ashamed of that. And I still am.
You spent close to 2 years in federal prison?
I did. Just a small, and then I'll expand on it. I was not charged. My defalcations came to light, and I reported this to the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility in 1992. The revocation order was entered in January of 1993. There had been ongoing negotiations and discussions among my parents, my former law partners, the malpractice carrier, the representatives of my clients, which included Bill Brandt, to try to resolve the damage that I had done. I was not charged until, actually, there was an agreed plea that we entered in June of 1993. The sentencing hearing was in front of Judge Warren, which was another shame and embarrassment. I had known him well. I tried cases in front of him when he joined the federal bench in Milwaukee in the mid-70s. I used to see him on a regular basis, and I had to go before him as an attorney and a thief. I was sentenced to 27 months. I served 24 months, of which 6 months were spent primarily in a home confinement setting. I was working, living at home, reporting in every day. I was sentenced to a federal camp in Oxford, Wisconsin, which is where many of the white-collar federal criminals are assigned. The typical situation at that camp is for someone who is educated to teach a class or two in the camp building. There were other opportunities, one of which I volunteered for. And they found it humorous, but I volunteered to work in the sewer treatment plant that served both the fenced prison, which is a medium security prison, and the camp, which was a non-secure facility. I did that for a period of time until I became the camp power, the utilities for the camp. I became the clerk. And as a result of those services, I qualified for, and it was recommended both by Judge Warren and by the camp administrator that I go to Denver, basically, and I spent a little more than 9 months at the Fitzsimmons Army Medical Hospital, which is in Aurora. It's now been disbanded totally, but I spent the majority or almost the equal time doing that at the medical hospital as I did in the camp, and then I returned to Milwaukee. So I served a 24-month sentence. I received initially a 3-year probationary period. At the end of that period, especially because I had missed a number of months' payments that I was supposed to be making, that was extended another 3 years, and that ended in 2000.
Those were support payments? You missed payments for what? Support?
The restitution that I was paying to the federal court that was attributable originally to the Milwaukee Cheese ESOT subsequently. And I did catch up with those payments even before that hearing. I made additional payments along the way, and that's why it's now reduced to, as I said, under $3,000.
Mr. Jennings, if your license was reinstated, what would you do?
I have a background in real estate. My real estate broker's license was reinstated, although I have not actively pursued the real estate industry lately. It's not very strong either. Furniture business has its ups and downs as well. But I feel strongly that there are a number of things that I can do. There's a great need for volunteer services in bankruptcy matters in Milwaukee, as a specific example. If my license was reinstated, I could be very available to do that. I would like to work for a real estate development firm, something along those lines, because I have a lot of background experience, attention to the detail that's required. I don't believe that I will return to the trial practice that I once had. It's almost 20 years. I've had a few opportunities, only on my own behalf, obviously not on behalf of clients, to appear in court, but I don't think that that's my strong suit. And things have changed, even though I have maintained competence in the law. I've attended on a regular basis all of the courses that I can afford. I look for the ones that our Marquette University, for example, has some that are very inexpensive or at no cost. The Milwaukee Bar Association has too. I have maintained competency in the law, and that's, I don't believe, has been an issue at all as this thing has evolved. But my intention would be to practice in a collegial setting, not in a trial practice, both to assist people on bankruptcy matters and with respect to real estate matters. Your Honor, I think that I have previously addressed this, and I'm addressing again now. One of the issues that came out of the referee's report, which I appealed, she failed to be satisfied that I showed sufficient remorse at that hearing on the 12th of October last fall. And without disputing her conclusion, I would like this court to look at the totality of the circumstances over all these years. I had submitted numerous letters of support where many people who knew me well in a professional setting and for a long period of time reiterated how remorseful I had shown, what remorse I had shown to them and how remorseful I was, have been, and am now. I can't say that enough. I have tried to demonstrate that, as I said, by acknowledging the responsibility. There was no equivocation on my part when this came to light. I immediately resigned. I've tried to do all those things that I can within my power and limited economic circumstances to parcel out the money that I've earned to pay the people who I have done harm to.
In your jobs, Mr. Jennings, did you handle other people's money?
Yes.
For example?
Well, I was responsible for daily cash receipts in the 15 or so years that I was in the furniture business, both with the first job that I had when I came back to Milwaukee in 1995 with a company that also no longer exists, the Heiligmeyer Furniture Company, which was headquartered in Richmond, Virginia. I joined them in March of 1995 when I returned to Milwaukee initially as an outside collector. In other words, somebody who went to a customer who hadn't been paying on their installment agreements at their home. I went to their home and tried to either collect money or repossess the furniture. I very quickly became the credit manager for the company. I was responsible for the daily cash, which many times exceeded $10,000. I was responsible for, I worked up to a store manager pretty quickly, was responsible for the furniture inventory, the daily cash responsibilities. There were plenty of opportunities where I probably could have done something inappropriate. I clearly never did. In fact, I was eventually doing the audits on behalf of the company for other stores in the area. At the Porter Furniture Company, where I was for so many years, again, I had daily cash responsibilities on a regular basis. And I know my red light is on.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel. Julie Marie spoke, representing the complainant, Office of Lawyer Regulation.
May it please the Court, my name is Julie Spoke, and I represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation in the pending reinstatement proceeding. In this reinstatement proceeding, Mr. Jennings has the burden to prove by clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that he has the moral character to practice law in Wisconsin, that his resumption of the practice of law will not be detrimental to the administration of justice or subversive to the public interest, and that his representations in the petition are substantiated. In this case, the referee properly concluded that Jennings failed to prove that he has a proper understanding and attitude towards the standards that are imposed upon the members of the bar, and that he will act in conformity with these standards, that he can safely be recommended to the legal profession and the public as a person fit to be consulted by others and to represent them in matters of trust and confidence, and he has made restitution to and settled all claims of persons injured or harmed by the petitioner's misconduct. Although the OLR did not object to Mr. Jennings' reinstatement, the OLR submitted a reinstatement response which stressed numerous concerns that the OLR had concerning his reinstatement. These concerns included, but were not limited to, that he expressed little empathy towards the victims of his crimes, his tendency to protect his family over the victims of his crimes, the fact that Mr. Jennings violated court orders, and that Mr. Jennings failed to negotiate any of the debts owed to the victims of his crimes. The referee carefully looked at all OLR's concerns, and based upon the evidence and the testimony presented at the hearing, and in particular Jennings' testimony, his demeanor, and his credibility, the referee determined that Jennings failed to meet his burden.
So is this correct to say that when the petition for reinstatement was filed, you really took no position with regard to whether or not he should be reinstated? However, now it is your position that you support the referee's conclusions and findings. Is that correct?
We took no position. We didn't object to his reinstatement. We didn't openly support his reinstatement. We stressed a number of concerns and emphasized to the referee that she should carefully look at these concerns and take those in consideration in determining whether or not he's met his burden for reinstatement.
How do we review this? Is there a dispute on the facts here?
I do not believe there's a dispute on the facts. I believe that the court's focus on this case is as to the referee's determinations of credibility at the reinstatement proceeding.
As to credibility. And
correct.
What else?
And whether or not her decision, based upon that credibility, met essentially that he met his burden as a matter of law, that he should not be entitled to reinstatement based upon those credibility determinations.
That's what I'm getting at, of course. So no dispute of facts. So the question is then, as a matter of law, do we say that, now let's see, I'm going to go through the provisions she found were not met. And when I miss one, you're going to tell me what they are, okay? Because I'm looking for my little list, which I don't have, but G is one of them, right? You've got them? F, G, and 4M. Okay, F.
Yes.
The petitioner has a proper understanding of an attitude toward the standards that are imposed upon members of the bar and will act in conformity with the standards.
Correct. I believe she lumped F and G together, although she separated it out a little bit in her
opinion. All right, I'll lump them.
Essentially, when she...
Let me read G, okay?
Yes.
The petitioner can safely be recommended to the legal profession, the courts, and the public as a person fit to be consulted by others, represent them, and otherwise act in matters of trust and confidence, and in general, to aid in the administration of justice as a member of the bar and an officer of the court.
Okay. With regard to F and G under 2229, essentially the referee listened to Mr. Jennings' testimony and assessed his demeanor and credibility at the hearing. After the testimony was over with, she basically, there's two points that she found that found that she believed he lacked any feeling of remorse or apology towards the victims of his crime, and that's in essence why she made those determinations. One of those points was because she found that in 1992, shortly after the discovery of his defalcations, he granted a mortgage to his parents, which gave them preferential treatment over the victims of his crime.
Well, weren't they victims, too?
Pardon me?
Weren't they victims, too?
His mother was victimized. Okay. His father was not. But what her concern was is that he continues to defend his actions to give his parents priority over the victims. And he's argued at the hearing, he's argued in his appellate brief, that the mortgages do not give his parents preferences over others, and that his parents had legitimate claims against him that were duly concerned, or duly secured, pardon me. Basically, this is despite the fact that when he provided the mortgages to his parents, it was not only for money that he already owed his parents, it was for money that they had agreed to potentially borrow to him in settlement of some of the claims with regard to his defalcations. When his parents learned the extent and gravity of how much money he had actually, in fact, stolen from his clients, they declined to help him.
What year was that mortgage, Ms. Spoke?
The year was 1992.
So what should he do? It's 20 years later. What should he do to undo the 1992 mortgage so that you would say he has shown remorse?
The fact,
and at what point has he done enough?
Go ahead. He can't undo the mortgages. The fact is that he's continued to defend his decisions to provide his parents with the mortgages. He's continued to claim that these mortgages did not give his parents preferential treatment, and he continues to claim that they had legitimate claims that were duly secured.
Okay, so it's not that he did it to begin with that bothers you. It's the fact that he continues to say that it wasn't wrong to do
Correct.
That.
What else?
Well, if I can just emphasize one point about the mortgages. At the hearing, Jennings...
Which hearing?
At the most recent hearing for his reinstatement that we're discussing today, Jennings denied that the mortgage gave his parents preference over others, and this is just something that the referee looked at and highly considered when she was making her decision. A part of his testimony is when he asked if he agreed that giving his parents the mortgages in 1992 and that it gave them priority for some of the victims of the crimes, Jennings responded, absolutely not. The mortgage has no value. When asked again if he agreed that when he sold the property in 1997, those mortgages gave him priority over the funds of the sale of the property, Jennings again responded, absolutely not, absolutely not. I don't agree with that. And there's no documentation or evidence in the record that I'm aware of that it would. Jennings continued to maintain this position in his appellate brief. He continued to argue that Jennings continues to maintain that, not because of the 1992 mortgage, but rather that his parents had legitimate claims against him, which were the basis for his parents to have received a portion of the 1997 proceeds of the sale of all the property then owned by Jennings and his former spouse.
Is it your position he should have paid the non-relatives first?
He should have considered the victims of the crimes over his family members.
Well, do you agree that the family was a victim, too?
His mother was a victim.
Okay. Do we agree his mother was a victim?
Pardon me?
Do we agree his mother was a victim?
Yes, we agree his mother was a victim of not that specific crime, but where he stole $80,000 to $100,000 from her estate. That's correct.
All right. Did he owe that money back to his mother?
Yes, and he still owes that money back to his mother's estate.
He says he paid about 43% of it, did he?
He paid 0.43 to his parents, both of his parents together, his mother and his father. They were divorced, so basically there was money that went to his mother, there was money that went to his father at the time he sold the property.
Did you say that some of the mortgage to his parents was in consideration for money he borrowed from them to pay to those other persons from whom he stole money?
Not money he borrowed, but money that he contemplated borrowing from his parents. He never, in fact, borrowed that money. It never came to fruition because they determined not to participate in any settlements.
I see. Thank you.
Counsel, Justice Ziegler commented, it's 20 years later now. What can he do? And we've discussed this issue regarding priority payments to parents. Is there anything else that you have in response to that question of Justice Ziegler as what can he do to gain reinstatement? Or what? Can he gain reinstatement from your position?
I don't believe this is a permanent revocation case. I believe that this, you know, Mr. Jennings can at some point obtain reinstatement.
Okay, what can he do to obtain reinstatement other than come to terms, from your perspective, with this priority payment to parents? Other than that, what else need he do to get reinstatement?
Well, there's several things. One thing I think that Mr. Jennings should do, just to go back to the referee's report, I believe in essence the referee was stating in her opinion that she didn't feel that Mr. Jennings had the moral character to practice. She didn't feel he met his burden, that he has the moral character to practice law in Wisconsin. I believe one thing that would have assisted Mr. Jennings is if instead of having three witnesses testify at the hearing that had fairly minimal contact with Mr. Jennings, if he would have had somebody from his previous employer come, either from Helig Myers or from Porter Furniture, and testify either the owner, a supervisor, or a coworker as to his moral character in his job at Porter Furniture, his handling of money, and how he was trustworthy while he was working at Porter Furniture. I think that would have assisted Mr. Jennings. He didn't have that at the hearing.
Can I just ask you a practical question? Does someone come to this hearing sort of trying to guess what it is you might want to know and present what they've got? Or do you say, you know what, here's what we need to see from you, and here's the kind of evidence we need to have from you. And if you have this, we're going to recommend you for reinstatement. And if you don't, we're not going to recommend you. Now, I understand you sort of stood silent here. But does anybody, the referee or anyone, tell the person, these are the things we want to see? Or are these kind of moving targets, like moral character? You know, I mean, people may define that differently. Or, you know, some people, when they respond to a question, I'm thinking of my kids, for example. Sometimes if they're in trouble, they start laughing. Well, that's a completely inappropriate response, right? But that sometimes people don't respond the way you want them to. They just have their own sort of defense mechanism or way of responding. That may be offensive to some people, but it may be the way that they happen to react. And it may be very genuine that inside they feel terrible, but their outward appearance. I want to know, what exactly do you tell people so that they know this is what I have to do specifically so that I meet these criteria? Or does it just kind of move around and it depends on the day?
Well, I don't believe that there's a specific blueprint that an attorney receives. However, there are the Supreme Court rules which indicate what their burden is and what they need to prove at the hearing. Up to this point, it's been found by referee Vokey back in 2007 and also referee Taylor just recently that he has not yet met his burden. I believe there's been discussions both back when he applied for reinstatement in 2007 that addressed these same and similar issues. I believe that the Supreme Court order that went out as a result of the 2007 denial of reinstatement essentially indicated what the Supreme Court's concerns were with regard to his reinstatement.
I'm hearing good, specific ideas from you. We'd like to hear from your employers. We'd like to hear that you handled the money right. We'd like to hear this or that. Did he know that going into this hearing?
I believe, and this it's my assumption that he was told that back at the earlier reinstatement proceeding, that that's something that might be helpful to him. I don't know that for a fact, but I was told that he may have been informed that.
Can I ask Justice Ziegler's question in a more general way? What I think she's driving at is, does the OLR view itself as a helper to somebody whose license has been revoked, so that when the person seeks reinstatement, would you reach out to that person and say, Now, Mr. Jennings, or Mr. X, or Ms. X, here's your record. On the basis of our experience, long experience, in lawyer discipline, we think if you're going to make your case, you should do A, B, C, D, and E. So, are you an adversary? Is this an adversarial proceeding on revocation? And reinstatement. Or do you view yourself as on both sides of the issue? That you will lend, and Mr. Jennings is representing himself, but Mr. Jennings could have hired a lawyer, right?
Correct.
So, what is OLR's posture? Do you understand the question?
And just so you know, that's the chief's question. That is not my question.
Yes.
So go ahead and answer my question.
When I throw out just concerns and what may have helped Mr. Jennings, I can't say per se if he would have had an employer testify that he would have been reinstated, but these are just ideas or suggestions that maybe if he would have done that, the referee would have felt differently at the proceeding. The OLR cannot give Mr. Jennings legal advice. We can't tell him what he needs to provide in order to prove that he's met the reinstatement standards. I believe that the reinstatement standards are subjective by the referee, and the referee listens to all the facts and the evidence presented at the hearing, and based upon accumulation of all the evidence presented, determines whether or not an attorney has met their burden of proof. The OLR conducts a very thorough investigation of an attorney when they apply for or file their petition for reinstatement, and looks at all the various factors that are set forth in the Supreme Court rules, and then forms an opinion based upon its investigation as to whether or not that attorney has met those factors. For example, in this case, the OLR felt that Mr. Jennings did meet a majority of those factors in 2229. However, there were concerns with regard to several of those factors that the OLR stressed to the referee in this case.
Which ones were those? Was it F, G, and 4N?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was based upon his conduct and his and not only were we talking about, you know, other witnesses that he may have provided, however, even at the hearing, the referee felt at the hearing that Mr. Jennings did not show any remorse towards the victims of his crime by his testimony that he presented at the hearing.
Counsel, I appreciate the nuanced position that OLR is bringing to this and the attempted nuance of your responses to these questions. I'd like to return to a more discreet area of inquiry, and that is of restitution. I'm a little unclear as to, and would you please tell me what your reading of the record indicates, the aggregate amount of restitution that Mr. Jennings has been ordered to pay as a result of his misconduct?
Sure, absolutely. As a result of the indictment, he was ordered to provide restitution to several individuals. He was ordered to pay $471,000 to Milwaukee Cheese, $79,000 to Sheboygan Sausage, and then $39,750 to the Employee Stock Ownership Trust. However, there was an adversary bankruptcy proceeding in which a judgment was entered against Mr. Jennings for $550,200.
So a reduction of about $50,000.
Correct. And then at that point, the law firm, Godfrey Braun and Hayes, the malpractice insurer, and DSI, which is Development Specialties, Inc., agreed to pay both Milwaukee Cheese and Sheboygan Sausage a $500,000 settlement. They then assigned that $550,000 judgment to the law firm. At this point, the restitution that's owed is and this is taking into consideration that in 1997, he did sell his property. And as a result, $152,520 went to the law firm and to the insurer. The law firm is now owed, as a result, $397,680. However, there has been some arguments as to whether or not Mr. Jennings brought some money into the firm that should be credited. and that has never been determined.
Have there been any payments from Mr. Jennings since his judgment of being ordered to pay the restitution?
Since the order to pay restitution, Mr. Jennings has only provided the law firm with the proceeds from the sale of his property in 1997. He has made no further payments to the law firm
at that time. And that was the $152,000?
Correct.
Okay.
He has made no payments to the law firm at all since that time, and he has made no attempts except for, he did, after this court's last decision in 2007 to deny reinstatement, he did attempt to contact the law firm, and this in the decision, this court was very concerned about his failure to make determinations as to what, in fact, he actually owed the law firm. After that, he sent a letter to the law firm in both March of 2009 and then again in September of 2009, quoting this court's decision and then asking the law firm if they could determine how much he actually owes them. Since then, he hasn't made any attempts to determine what he actually, in fact, owes the law firm, nor has he made any attempts to provide restitution to the law firm.
Now, this all goes to 4M.
Correct.
Because 4M said petitioner has made restitution to or settled claims, right, including reimbursement to the client's protection fund. And if not, the explanation for the failure of inability to do so. So I have not read the record below, but was in the basis of the referee's opinion and the financial statements filed, if any, was he able to make payments and restitution after 97?
It's not clear if, in fact, he was able to make restitution payments. I do know that he was working at the furniture store at the time.
You know how much money he made per year?
Making around $50,000 to $60,000, it's my understanding. And he can correct that when he comes up if that's not exactly correct. I guess the problem isn't that he hasn't made full restitution to the law firm. The problem here is that he hasn't even, what's troubling, and I think what concerned the referee and what concerned this court back in 2007 when he applied for reinstatement is that he hasn't made any efforts to even determine what, in fact, he owes the law firm. And then on top of that, besides, he did make one offer to settle his claims with the law firm for $6,000, which was rejected. Other than that, he hasn't made any other attempts to try to settle with the law firm or even make any minimal payments towards them, nor has he expressed any plans in the future to provide restitution to the law firm.
Counsel, if I recall correctly, the referee indicated, and maybe it was because of an investigator of OLR, had contacted Attorney Hugh Brown, who's a principal in the former law firm, and that Hugh Brown indicated through the OLR investigator that it was likely that he and his current partners would forgive all or most of Jennings' debt to them and release the judgment against him, because he'll likely never pay it. Of what import at all is that information to us? Should we consider it? It seemed kind of like an outlier to me, a comment made, not in testimony, was it?
No, it was not in testimony.
No, just kind of an offhand comment.
It's just a side comment made by a partner at his law firm. Nothing's been resolved with the law firm to date, though, and I don't know how much consideration this court can actually give to that comment. Mm-hmm. They haven't agreed to settle with him. They haven't agreed to release any of the judgment at this point.
My essential question, I think, in this case, in part ties into the Gary George case. And in the Gary George case, there was restitution that was still due and owing. And there was also a question of remorse. And we said in our George opinion, we are reluctant to hold that an individual must explicitly admit wrongdoing to be reinstated. With regard to the issues of remorse and remorse and restitution, thank you. How can you distinguish this from the George case?
Well, it can be distinguished from George in that, first off, in George, they were talking about whether or not he accepted responsibility for his original crime. And in this case, there has been acceptance of responsibility, at least for the initial defalcation, which was the theft of $500,000-some from his clients, as well as the theft from his mother. So I don't think there's a question as to whether or not he admits culpability for the underlying misconduct. And unlike George, the focus here is that, in essence, Mr. Jennings hasn't really expressed remorse towards the victims. Yeah, he's accepted responsibility for the initial wrongdoing. However, except for paying restitution to individuals that had to, in fact, be paid, such as the court-ordered restitution payments that he's been making on a monthly payment and the payment that he made to the Department of Revenue and the IRS, he hasn't made any attempts to even determine what he owes these individuals that were, in fact, harmed by his defalcations, nor made any attempts or plans to even provide any restitution to them in the first place. I may think of a concern of the referee was his attitude that, well, if I had the money, I'd pay it, but I don't.
Counsel,
and
appreciate and understand that you responded to the question I asked. That is, the quote that I read from George says, we are reluctant to hold that an individual must explicitly admit wrongdoing to be reinstated. And your response was, well, unlike George, where there wasn't an explicit admission of wrongdoing, here there was, so it's unlike George. But in my opinion, implicit in that statement is, if you're not going to admit to an initial wrongdoing, it is reasonable to infer you're not going to have any remorse for doing it or to the victims because you didn't do anything. So I think although what I read to you dealt with some remorse for the initial wrongdoing, I think a logical extension of that is that George had no remorse for victims if he didn't do anything wrong. So how do you contrast that here? Why should we be considering the alleged or apparent lack of remorse for the victims when we said in George we are reluctant to hold that an individual must explicitly admit wrongdoing to be reinstated?
Well, I think in George, obviously, if he's not going to admit that he engaged in the original crime, he's not going to have any remorse towards his victims.
Right. So remorse, it seems to me we could have said we are reluctant to hold that an individual must explicitly express remorse in order to be reinstated, although I understand 4M deals with restitution and
What I believe the referee was concerned about was his remorse towards his victims and his tendency to place himself and his family over his victims, to provide the mortgages to his parents, including his father, who was not a victim of the crime, to pay his wife and son child support and maintenance, diverting funds back to himself, or at least protecting his funds from any garnishment by the victims of the crime, as opposed to actually paying out funds to the victims or, you know, at least allowing them to garnish some of his wages. My understanding or what I believe the concern was is that an attorney practicing law has to put the client over and above themselves. The benefit to the client over and above any of their own interests or the interests of their family. It's my understanding that the referee's concern here is that if Mr. Jennings does practice law, that there may be a tendency to place his own interest and his family interests over that of his clients based upon his past defenses with regard to what he's done to protect his family as well as his failure to provide any restitution to any of the victims, or determine even what those amounts were.
May I ask this question?
Justice Prosser.
Where does this case rank in terms of gravity of the cases you've seen since you've been with OLR?
As to the initial misconduct was very serious. And this misconduct not only involved the theft of $500,000 from his clients, but it was also during, while he was engaging in the practice of law, which is very serious misconduct. And I believe that's one of the things that the referee took into account, or one of the factors the referee took into account in making her decision in this case, is the severity of the crime, which essentially this court has held in Heidman that Jennings does not, that there is no presumption of rehabilitation at the expiration of revocation, even where there is no evidence of intervening or subsequent misconduct. And a petitioner for reinstatement has the burden to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that he or she possesses the requisite moral character to practice law. And I believe it was appropriate for the referee to consider the seriousness of that misconduct and that it involved his practice of law in making a determination as to whether or not he met his burden of proof in this case. My red light is up, so if there are no further questions, the OLR would just ask this court to adopt referee Taylor's recommendation and deny Jennings' petition for reinstatement. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Spoke. Mr. Jennings.
Thank you. The OLR did file a very detailed report last summer, which did clearly indicate that while there were some concerns, the director of the OLR did not oppose reinstatement. That many-page document incorporated the reports and the statements from my former employers as to how well I had handled money and how diligent, responsible, competent I had been. It did not appear to be a contested matter. Certainly the OLR did not further investigate, even question any of those individuals, but accept it as true, as has the referee in this case. He also made reference to the work history that I had. What I've heard from the OLR attorney in the last several minutes basically were her understandings of what she thought the referee may have relied on. But the referee's report did not indicate that I was irresponsible, didn't indicate that I had failed to make efforts to contact my law firm. The facts are, and they're very clear in the record, I had been in regular contact with members of my law firm for a very long period of time on a regular basis. In fact, the specific settlement offer that Attorney Spoke referenced, a $6,000 payment, that was in a letter in 2006. That was prior to the 2007 petition for reinstatement. I have met with Attorney Brown on a regular basis. No, he did not come to the hearing and testify, but I think it's clear in the record that we have reached a point of accommodation which is being pursued at this point in time.
What does that mean, Mr. Jennings? What is your understanding of what you owe the law? What is your understanding?
My understanding is that as between...
Mr. Jennings?
Yes, sir.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
I'm curious to know, because Ms. Spoke mentioned it, what is your understanding of what you owe the law firm?
Can I give just a real brief background? Yes. There is a federal criminal restitution order, which now is from $590,000 is now below $3,000, approximately $2,500. There is a civil judgment. I prepared the documentation after 6 months or more of wrangling, no more than that. The case was started in September of 1993. I had filed an answer that admitted all the allegations. In June of 1993, the case was filed in September of 92. In June of 1993, at a pretrial, I walked in with the forms of judgments that I had circulated more than 6 months before then and said, Judge, will you enter the civil judgment against me? That was for $550,000. It was that civil judgment that was assigned to my former law firm. That's where the $397,000 figure comes from. That's the balance due on a civil judgment which my former partners hold.
Does that run at 12%? Does it run at 12% judgment rate of interest?
Judgment rate would be 12%, yes. And that judgment is effective for 20 years. And that time would expire at a period of time. I have a moral obligation to my partners, and I've addressed that. And I've attempted on numerous occasions to determine what that is. Hugh Brown, who this court, I think, remembers well, he's an honest and respectable individual. He said, David, you don't have the money. And that's the real problem here, is I haven't. And I did, unfortunately, not earn $50,000 to $60,000 during the time I was working for the furniture company. I had 1 year where I was more than $50,000. Most of the time it was as low as $20,000 to as much. But that dollar figure has been carefully scrutinized by the taxing authorities, by the OLR, by the probation department, as to how much money. Now, there's one other point of disagreement. The hearing last fall, I think, was somewhat adversarial in that there were a series of questions that I answered. The questions were, did the 1992 mortgage grant to my parents a priority position over my former law partners who then had the judgment? And I think I took a legal view of that theory of question, because that mortgage was wrong in hindsight. It was granted in 1992 to my parents because they were going to come up with $250,000 toward a settlement. That settlement document is in the record. We've looked at it. That did not happen. But my position has always been, and this is a problem because it showed, apparently, a lack of remorse, that my mother had as much right through her lawyers. They were all represented by attorneys during this time period. My mother had a right to pursue her claim. My father also had purchase money mortgage interest in portions of the property, some of which had been released. But I did contend that they had a right to pursue their claims. They had lawyers who represented them in the pursuit of those claims. It did not mean, and it does not mean, that they had a prior right or a superseding right. I felt that they had, in hindsight, when asked the question, they had an equal right to pursue their claims through their lawyers in the court proceedings. But I had no control over that once that mortgage in 1992 was given. I have...
Was there an attempt to upset that mortgage?
No. None whatsoever.
Gave the mortgage, no one else, your law firm didn't go against them and say, hey, we share proportionately.
I think they did that by agreement. There was no...
Who did that? Who did what by agreement?
I'm sorry. My mother had died by 1997. My mother's trust and her attorney, Judy Drinka, my father, who was very active still, and his lawyer, Chuck Schrader, and primarily the attorney for the firm's law malpractice carrier. I had no part in that.
I
had generated the money. I had, after the farm was going into foreclosure and there was a sheriff's sale and it was going to pay off the M&I bank and nothing left, I asked for 30 days. I obtained 30 days. I found third-party buyers. So instead of the property being sold at sheriff's sale for $388,000, I got $770,000 and said, here's the pot. It's a typical, in a contested manner, say, here's the pot. You guys figure out what you want to do. And I stayed out of that. But that was the result of their discussion.
What was the result of their discussion, Mr. Jennings?
The result of their discussion is my parents got 43 cents on the dollar, and the law firm and the malpractice insurer got 43 cents on the dollar. Development specialists got nothing. However, and I think this is significant too, Bill Brand, a development specialist who were the persona of my client, have testified in each instance in support of my reinstatement based on the service that I'd previously performed, and what's happened in the interim.
43 and 43 is 86.
43% of their claim amounts.
Ah, okay.
And those dollars added up to $250,000. Okay. Yes. My parents' claims were paid at 43 cents on the dollar. And I think Attorney Spoke is correct. I don't know it was equal between my parents, but they did agree on a dollar amount that was 43 cents on the dollar of their claim. And the firm and the malpractice carrier received 43 cents
back. Is this all in the record?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. The OLRs argued that my parents got a greater percentage because they included development specialists' interest, but again, they didn't get anything. You can do the math different ways. I have offered, Justice Gableman, in response to your question, I have communicated with my former law firm on a very regular annual basis and have sat down with them and tried to work things out with them. I have not directly paid them any money since 1997. That's been made clear before and currently. And they haven't asked for anything. They've never garnished my wages or done anything. What I did do, and this is some years ago, for lack of any other opportunity and lacking any agreement as to what was to be done, I had made them beneficiaries of the life insurance that I have in my life, and I make payments on that, and I maintain that for their benefit. But
how much is that? How much is the life insurance policy?
It's about $15,000, Judge. Mm-hmm. When I was employed, I had some term insurance. When the company closed, I don't have that anymore. I have permanent insurance. Death benefits about $15,000. I wish I had more, and I've said that. I feel, as I've tried over the years to do this, I feel like that Greek mythological figure, Sisyphus. I keep rolling the stone up the hill, believing I know where I'm going. Based on the limited guide that I have, which are the other cases that I've looked at, and I reach near the top, and that stone rolls to the bottom once again. But what has changed in the last 2 years are the two principal cases that I refer to in my briefs. The court's already addressed the Gary George case, which was significant in dollars and result, and also the Michael Graw case, where while he did not directly take money from his client's accounts, he and an insider at his client apparently were engaged in a scheme that was as much as $20 million. Attorney Graw was reinstated almost immediately after his federal supervised release was over. Mine's been over for almost 10 years. He agreed to repay $4.4 million to his former law firm, to his former client. His law firm, according to the written report, repaid over $1 million of fees to the former client. And Attorney Grawl had paid, by the time he was reinstated, about $2.5 million of the $4.4 million that the report indicated that he had agreed to pay. He had missed a $600,000 payment the year before reinstatement. He had assets, but his assets were not liquid, and he deferred that payment for a period of time. His father helped him pay the original payments that he did to the client. My father was willing to a point. That didn't happen. But again, I was caught up in defending my parents' rights to pursue their claims, to implying that the mortgage that was granted in 1992 was appropriate. And I did not mean that then. I don't mean that now. It was done for a specific purpose. My father had mortgage interests in the property, but they were limited because there were a number of parcels, and he had released his mortgage in the residence parcel and the stable parcel. But there were another five or six parcels that he originally had. I don't think this court needs to go through the details of that. I've had this has been addressed to referees in the past, and they hadn't really looked at it. My point previously was that they had agreed to the resolution of the proceeds of the sale of the property. I would make one final point.
But the red light's on.
I Please know that.
Do that.
If I could.
You may.
The referee last fall in her report did indicate clearly that there is no suggestion of bad moral character, at least since 2007, the prior return. And you can look at all the things that may have occurred before, and you can argue whether they do or don't. But I believe strongly that on a going forward basis, I'm very aware of what I did wrong, and I would never repeat anything like that. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jennings. We know how difficult this is for you, both you and the OLR and the court in dealing with professional responsibility and violations of the code. We appreciate you coming and making the argument. And you too misspoke. And this concludes our hearing in 92 AP 3208B, Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility. That is the OLR versus David V. Jennings. The court will take a brief recess so the students who wish to leave may leave and additional students may enter the courtroom. We are in recess.